Well, good afternoon, everybody. This is Bob Elson. We're set as usual with our Saturday afternoon show, and we're going to talk baseball today with an old friend. He and I were on the baseball beat together for many, many years, and Ed Froelich, a prominent big league trainer, was a trainer of a number of ball clubs, including the Yankees, the Boston Red Sox, the White Sox. What have I missed?
The Brooklyn Dodgers, the Blackhawks, and the Pro Football Cardinals.
And the Pro Football Cardinals. Who was with the Cardinals in those days?
Well, Bob, we were kind of a punt and a pass and a prayer team then. We didn't have a good team. We had fellows like Doug Russell and Mike Mikulak and Lou Gordon and Phil Handler. And we did not have a good team. We had to struggle. It was in the early days, and it was before Jimmy Konselman came in and built a powerhouse there. But it was a struggle, is what it was, Bob.
Were you there in the Konselman years?
No, I miss Konselman. I've always wished that I had been with him because he was a wonderful, wonderful man. Yeah. And such a colorful person and such a humorous guy. If you remember, Bob, he told a story about, they asked him what it was like playing the Bears in those days, and he said, no matter how you try to defense the Bears, he said, you always wind up with your guy who can run 109.8 chasing one of the Bears who can run 109.6. He also told a story about having a young club, and he said that they went to play a game at Comiskey Park, and he came in the dressing room, and he said there was nobody there. And he said fright came over him. He figured his team didn't show up. But then he said he looked around the floor, and he saw all this tape and bandages on the floor. So he said he knew they had been there. So he said he went looking further, and he said he went on the field, and he said there they were. They were all getting the Bears' autographs. Yeah, he's a great man. He's a great man. He's the fellow that coined the expression, he had played with Halas. And they used to ask him about Halas, and he used to say, he's the nicest rich man I know. He had done everything, Bob. Very talented man. He had written books. He had acted. He had been a prize fighter. He owned teams. He was a great player. And he also owned the Detroit Lions. And somebody asked him one day about being an intelligent guy. And he said, I'll tell you how intelligent I am. He said, I am the fella that sold the Detroit Lions franchise for $10,000. The one, he said, that sold for $5 million to Billy Ford. He said, that tells you something about how smart I am.
What do you notice as you watch, and I'm sure you enjoy college and pro football on the weekends like we all do, notice any change in the pro game?
Yes, many, many changes, Bob. It's hard to compare. They talk about the players today are bigger and faster and stronger, and you hear all these sorts of things. And it's difficult to make comparisons. The one thing I would like to point out is that when they talk about players being bigger and stronger and faster, you have to remember that when a 250-pound player hits a 250-pound player, the impact on those two players is no greater than a 185-pound player hitting a 185-pound player. In other words, the 185-pound player in those days took just as much of a beating as the player 250, because the guy hitting a guy 250, the fellow that's getting hit weighing 250, to him the force is no greater than it is on the guy 185 getting hit by 185 pounds. One of the things that I notice so much today is that the field, the AstroTurf, the synthetic surfaces, have now become the ruler of the player. It used to be that the player ruled the field when it was natural turf. Today, the field rules the player. In other words, it enables them to do many things that he couldn't do before. For example, cutting, changing his direction, speed. The speed is greater because he's running on a surface that gives him tremendous purchase, traction. But at the same time, it's causing all the injuries because the field enables the player to do things that his body cannot handle. That's the big difference that I noticed today, Bob.
There was an interesting story in the Tribune today about the big change in football is the accent on the forward pass.
That's true, Bob. They throw the ball a lot more, and there's a lot of reasons for that. And the big reason is the shape of the ball, Bob. In the old days, you didn't have perfect footballs. Some were big, some were fat, some had smooth surfaces. They had laces on them that the trainer used to prepare on Saturday. And I was with the Bears at the time, and we used to get 3 dozen footballs or 4 dozen footballs. And we would have 2 different kinds of footballs, one for the other team and one for the Bears. And we had 2 sacks on the sideline. And this might sound like a bizarre story, but it's the truth. On Saturday, we would pump up the balls, and the big fat ones that you could hardly grip, these were pumped up just as hard as you could possibly pump them so that you could scarcely make a dent in them with a sledgehammer. They were in 1 sack, and the ones that were nice and slim and had a nice rough grain on them that you could grip, they were not pumped up so hard, and these were the balls that the Bears used. Now, Driscoll was a great kicker, and on 4th down, when he would punt, he would make sure that the other team didn't get the ball because he would kick the ball out of bounds, and now a new ball would come in, and this is the one for them. You couldn't throw it. Now, if you want to call that cheating, you can call it cheating, but that's what you might call the home team advantage, and it's a big one.
That's a pretty good story. I never heard that before.
That's an absolute fact. We used to spend, Lacho and I used to spend all Saturday afternoon getting the balls ready for Sunday, and the balls were in a big burlap sack. And inside the burlap sack, there was another burlap sack, and these were 2 different kind of balls. Of course, in those days, so many different things exist today that didn't exist then. For example, the referees used to have to change clothes in the Bears' dressing room. And woe to the referees if the Bears lost. I can remember Bobby Kahn standing on the landing outside, shivering in the cold, saying, I'm not going in there until they leave, because the Bears have been beat that day. Do you remember Bobby Kahn?
I remember that little guy so well.
He used to dive into the pile. He only weighed about 90 pounds, and he used to dive in there, and they used to dive on top of him. But I can remember him shivering.
Well, I remember him. I'll never forget Bobby Kahn.
He was a good referee.
Oh, he was.
Yes, he was.
He was dedicated to the game, too.
Yes, he was. He didn't have to referee, but he refereed because he loved it. But I can remember him standing on that landing many a time saying to me, I'd say, why don't you go in there now, Bobby? He'd say, not me. I'm going to wait until they leave. And he'd shiver out there for maybe an hour until everybody was gone. He's not going in that lion's den.
What do you remember about Charlie Bidwell?
The only way I can describe Bidwell is to tell you, he was one of God's gentlemen. Yeah. He was a wonderful, wonderful man. Well, to give you an illustration of the type of person he was, Bob, we had a player named Hal Pangle who came out of Oregon. And before a game started, Bob, he had the most tremendous ability that you ever saw in your life. He could throw a ball 70 yards. He could punt a ball 70 yards. He could run like a deer. But the minute the referee blew the whistle, he couldn't do anything. So he was with us, and he played, and Creighton played him one day, and he got us beat. Next Sunday, he played him again, and he got us beat again. And Creighton went to Bidwell, and he said, that fellow's got to go. And Charlie looked at him with almost tears in his eyes. He said, you can't do that, Milan. He said, why not? He said, you can't do it. So Creighton said, okay. He said, you can do whatever you want with him, but I promise you, I am not ever going to play him again. Now, he said, if you want to put him up on top of the roof scouting, he said, all right with me, as far away from the field as possible. But tell me why you don't want to get rid of him. And Bidwell said, Milan, he goes to the movies with Stormy every day, and it would break Stormy's heart if I got rid of him. Stormy was 8 years old at the time. The guy stayed, Bob.
Yeah.
He didn't get rid of him. He wouldn't allow it.
That's quite a story. Our guest today, we're delighted to have him as an old friend and a former big league trainer, Dr. Ed Frohlich, and we'll be back with our guest in just a moment. Our guest today at Northwest Federal, and we're delighted to have him, is Doc Ed Froelich, former big league trainer, football trainer, and hockey trainer. Spent many years of his life in athletics. And, you know, we're all fortunate that we're either in the program or on the outside of the program or on the verge of the program. But an association with athletics is great, isn't it?
Oh, I should say so, Bob. There are businesses where maybe you could make more money, but if you have done the thing that you wanted to do, there's no amount of money that can take its place. In other words, with all the heartaches and all the second division finishes and all the near misses at pennants and all that sort of thing, it's been, you might say, a wonderful life. You know, you have things to look back on, and it's been rewarding.
Oh, yes, I should say so. And to see some of these youngsters come to the big leagues and blossom into a star. You know, I can remember guys like Lou Gehrig. I saw Gehrig when he started. Came out of Columbia washing dishes. He worked his way through Columbia washing dishes every day. Yes, he was a wonderful, wonderful person.
Yes, he was, Bob. He was, if the truth were to be told, he was probably the one ball player that was closest to McCarthy's heart.
Yeah, I believe that.
Yeah. He used to invite him to Buffalo during the winter if they would have some kind of a big affair, a sports affair or something like that. McCarthy always invited him to Buffalo. And he told a story about one day they were having a pre-party at McCarthy's house. And so Joey said, I'll be the bartender if you don't mind. And so he said, fine, go ahead. So he said, in about 30 minutes, Gehrig had everybody in the place looped. And he walked out there to him, and he said, what's the matter with you? He said, don't you know how to make a martini? He said, why don't you put an olive in there? And he said, put a twist of lemon in there. He said, and put some vermouth in there. Why aren't you doing these things? He said, you ought to know how to make some martini. Gehrig said, yeah, Joe, he said, but if I don't put those things in there, I can get more gin in the glass.
Oh, I remember them both so well. Joe McCarthy and I, unfortunately, had a little bit of a run-in. You remember that, don't you?
Well, I vaguely remember, Bob, but then I don't think...
One of his players said something on the air that caused we all had to go up and appear in Judge Landis's office the next morning, and he read a riot act to McCarthy. Yeah. And when we got out in the hall, McCarthy read a riot act to us. He said, no more Yankee ball players on those pregame shows. No more of that stuff. He said, if you want a Yankee ball player, you have an interview all written out. But somebody got to him, and I love Joe McCarthy.
Yeah. Well, see, there again, Bob, it's the unpredictable thing. How can you know what some person is going to say on the radio? You know, you have to be absolved of a thing like that. You're innocent of a thing like that. How can you tell what somebody is going to say? And a person in particular, he might say anything, anytime.
Well, we had the tape of the show, and the next morning when Landis called a meeting up there, we played the tape. We had the machine right on his desk. McCarthy was there, I was there, and the ball player was there. And I can remember Landis saying to Joe McCarthy, Joe, how in the hell can you blame Bob for that?
Yeah.
That kind of a question that he asked him didn't deserve that kind of an answer.
That's right.
You know.
That's right. That's right. Well, the ball player in question was a pretty unpredictable guy. He's the guy that told McCarthy that he was signing bad checks, and he told McCarthy that there was plenty of money in those banks, and McCarthy said, I know there is, but none of it belongs to you. He told McCarthy, he said, you tell that fellow one more, he said, and that'll be the last check he ever writes, he said, because he's out of baseball. And he had done that to one player. The Yankees lost one of the greatest pitching prospects they ever had, a fellow by the name of Roy Sherrod. And nobody ever signed him. He was out of baseball. That was the end of him. Brilliant pitcher. Brilliant. Brilliant. First year he pitched for the Yankees, he was 12-6. And Landis called Mr. Barrow, and he said, that fella is suspended from baseball for life. Just like that. If he gave you one warning, you were lucky.
Yeah.
But one was all. Just one.
Oh. See, I can remember Landis like it was yesterday. He and I, we had day games in those days, and they started at 3 o'clock, and then 2:30, and then 2 o'clock. And he'd call me in the morning and say, get there and order my lunch. He used to eat the same thing all the time in the Wrigley Building restaurant. And in knowing him like I did, that was really a privilege. He was a great, great man.
Yes, he was. Baseball today could use somebody like him. I'll guarantee you there'd be a lot of things different. He'd probably call somebody up to his office and then push him out of a window without even bothering to open it.
Yeah, Landis was a remarkable man. And the fortunate thing about it was he came to baseball when baseball needed a man like that.
You know, the most outstanding thing about him, Bob, was one year, and it was about 1944 when the war was on, and there were a few rumblings by owners that they didn't want him, that they wished he didn't have a long-term contract, and he called a joint meeting to order, and he had his contract on the little pedestal there serving as the speaker's thing, and he said, I understand some of you men are a little bit unhappy with the commissioner, and that only his long-term contract keeps him in office. He said, I want you to witness this, and he took his contract and tore it up in front of him and walked out the door. He got to the elevator, and about three of the owners ran out after him, and they said, that's not true. We want you. And only a lot of coaxing brought him back, but he tore his contract up, his long-term contract, right in front of him, and walked out of the door, and he said, now you're free to choose a successor.
Oh, what a man, what a man.
Yes, he was great, Bob. He was great. I remember the time that Gabby Hartnett had his picture taken with Capone. And Landis saw it, and he called Hartnett in. And he said, I don't ever, ever want to see your picture taken with Capone again. Is that clear? And Hartnett said, yes, sir. But he said, Judge, you tell him, will you?
Oh, see, he was I was fortunate that I knew him so well. I knew his lovely wife so well. He lived at the Ambassador, where I was doing a radio show in those days. But he was a great man. He was a great man for the time.
With all of his sternness, Bob, he had, there was a sense of balance with him. He called Clem in one time, and he was death, you know, on gambling. And he called Clem in, and he said, I understand, Bill, that you go to the races on off days. Well, this is a pretty well-known fact. And Clem looked at him, and he said, yes, sir, Judge, and I pay off 100 cents on the dollar. And Clem, Landis looked at him, and he said, okay, Bill, he said, have a nice day. All he wanted was just the truth. You better not lie to him, ever. He called Mike Kelly in.
Minneapolis.
Yes. And Kelly, in those days, used to get major league players, and when they would come down to him, he would say to him, now, if I sell you back to the big leagues, 10% of the purchase price will go to you, which made the guy hustle and gave him some incentive. So he got Carl Reynolds from the big leagues. And Carl Reynolds had a good year for him, and then they sold him to the Cubs when they needed an outfielder in 1938, and he gave Reynolds 10% of the purchase price, which is a pretty good hunk of dough. And Landis called him in, and he said, I understand that you tell players that you'll give them 10% of the purchase price. Mr. Kelly said, yes, sir, Judge. It's my money, and I'll give it to them one way or another. And the judge looked at him, and he said, Mike, there ought to be more men like you in baseball. Have a good day. So all he wanted was the truth. If he calls you in, he wanted the truth.
What do you remember about the guy who was a famous trainer of the Cubs, Andy Lotshaw?
He's a fabulous person, Bob. Yeah. One of the most fabulous people that ever was in the game. He was not because of his hands, Bob. His trainer's ability was kind of limited. He had stiff hands, which meant that he couldn't work on a player the way somebody else that had soft, relaxed hands could. And he also, because he had stiff hands, couldn't tape very well because he had to tape on top of gauze rather than on top of the skin. But he was a fabulous person. He was a human dartboard is what he was for the club. And from a morale standpoint, he was worth $1 million. In this day and age, he would have been a tremendous asset to a club as an equipment man, because he kept everybody on the club loose, and there was no such a thing as getting the last word with him ever, or topping him ever. For example, Malone used to kid him. Andy used to have trouble spelling and writing names and pronouncing them. And the Cubs at the time had Jack Lelevelt managing the Los Angeles team. Lachaw couldn't pronounce Lelevelt. He used to call him Leather Belt. So this particular year, Malone starts out with the Cubs, and he's 0-8, Bob. No wins and 8 losses. And he's kidding Lachaw. He's, "Hey, Andy, how do you pronounce that guy's name out in Los Angeles?" And Lachaw got a little bit burned up about it, and he said, "Don't you know?" And he said, "No, how do you pronounce his name?" Lachaw said, "You better learn, because you're 0-8, and you're going to be pitching for him real soon."
Oh, that's a very cute story. Doc, how's the business you're in now? We wanted to mention that.
Bob, we manufacture a back support cushion, which we sell all over the country in surgical supply stores, and which has been a big success, thank goodness.
What's the name of it?
It's the back support cushion, B-A-X-P-O-R-T cushion, and it's been a big, big success here at Northwest Federal Savings as a premium, and we're very proud of what it has done here.
Well, it's really great. Yes, it really is.
Yes, it is. We have customers who repeat and repeat and repeat and repeat the product because we've been selling it for 10 years now. And it's an old story that unless you have a good product, you're not going to repeat. You might fool people and sell them something one time, but you're not going to sell it to them over and over and over again.
Thanks for being with us today, Doc.
Nice being with you, Bob.
Our guest today was Dr. Ed Frohlich, very prominent big league trainer, very close to baseball. We were together for many, many years, and it's been very nice having him as a guest here at Northwest Federal. Have a happy day, and now this is Bob Elson saying goodbye until next Saturday at our usual time.